you don't like capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want?
And there is a great deal of new construction of new institutions, new forms, new cooperatives, new worker-owned companies that's happening all over the country.
This is the Gar Alperovitz Podcast, a regular look at the ideas of historian and political economist Gar Alperovitz as he explores strategies to democratize wealth and empower workers and communities.
Talk about ecological collapse and the alternative, and I'm going to argue strongly for a publicly owned, mostly planned society as the alternative, as the only alternative to ecological collapse. Okay, so last week, as people probably read in the New York Times, the concentration of CO2 parts per million in the atmosphere shot above 400 parts per million. This is just took the climate scientist, just really made people completely depressed. They've been trying for a decade and a half. The IPCC has been trying to convince governments and corporations to cut emissions so that they could get them back to 350 parts per million, which they thought, in their best science, is the necessary maximum level to keep it to keep us from a global warming beyond a degree and a half, which is the level beyond which melting will be hard, very hard to restrain. Well, 400 parts means it will be hard to even contain it within 2 degrees. And scientists were so blown away. Crossing this threshold fueled fears that we are, quoting from an article Scripps Ocean News, that we are fast approaching tipping points, melting the subarctic tundra and thaw and release of vast quantities of methane in the Arctic bottom that will accelerate global warming beyond any human capacity to stop it. Quote, I wish it weren't true, but it looks like the world is going to blow right through the 400 parts per million level without losing a beat, said Scripps geochemist Ralph Keeling. That's the son of Charles Keeling, who founded the Keeling Curve back in the 60s. Whose father, Keeling, set up the first monitoring stations at Mauna Loa in 1958. At this pace, we'll hit 450 in a few decades. It feels like the inevitable march toward disaster. Okay, so climate scientists like James Hansen, you probably know him, of Hansen, he's the world's preeminent climate scientist, have argued that what we have to do we have to make a massive compression contraction of the use of fossil fuels. We need to, in his word, coal emissions must be phased out as rapidly as possible or global climate disasters will be a dead certainty. Yes, coal, oil, gas, most of the fossil fuels must be left in the ground. That is the explicit message the science presents. Well, why can't we do this? I'm going to make a six-point argument here, why this is the case. First, and I'm sorry, I'm just slightly disorganized here because I was going to give a different talk following Gar, but Gar's going to go second. I'm rearranging my talk a little bit. Okay, first, the driving imperative here is capitalist reproduction. Capitalist corporations are just destroying the world before our very eyes. They can't help themselves. Corporations aren't necessarily evil, though plenty are diabolically evil, but they can't help themselves. They're just doing what they're supposed to do for their shareholders. Shell Oil can't help but loot Nigeria and the Arctic to cook the climate. IKEA can't help but level the forests of Siberia and Malaysia to feed the Chinese mills building its flimsy disposable furniture. IKEA is the third largest consumer of lumber in the world. Apple can't help it if the cost of extracting the rare earths needs to make its millions of new iThings each year. Is the destruction of the Eastern Congo, violence, rape, slavery, forced induction of child soldiers, along with poisoning of local waterways. Monsanto and DuPont and Syngenta and Bayer Crop Science have no choice but to wipe out bees, birds, butterflies, small farmers, and extinguish crop diversity to secure their grip on the world's food supply while drenching the planet with their Roundups and atrazines and neonicotinoids. This is how companies are wiping out life on Earth in the course of a routine business day. In Adam Smith's day, when the first factories and mills produced hatpins and iron tools and rolls of cloths by the thousands, capitalists' freedom to make whatever they wanted didn't matter much because it didn't have much impact on the environment. But today, when everything is produced in the millions and billions and then trashed today and reproduced all over again tomorrow, when the planet's looted and polluted to support all this insane and senseless growth, it matters a lot. The world's climate scientists have told us we're facing a planetary emergency. We need to suppress greenhouse gas emissions by 90% by 2050, or our goose is cooked. Yet, despite all the alarming, the ringing alarm bells, every capitalist government of the world is putting pedal to the metal to accelerate growth, to drive us off the full throttle off the cliff to collapse. That's the first point. Secondly, solutions to the ecological crisis are blindingly obvious. But we can't take any of the necessary steps to prevent collapse because to do what we have to do to prevent collapse tomorrow would precipitate economic collapse today. We all know what we have to do. We have to suppress greenhouse gas emissions, stop over-consuming natural resources, stop producing so much waste and polluting the planet with toxic chemicals. Mostly, we just have to stop doing what we're doing. But we can't stop because we're all locked into an economic system in which companies have to grow to compete and because we all need the jobs. Take climate change. Greenhouse gases are produced across the economy. It's often thought that when I read this stuff, much of the discussion about global warming and so forth is about people very often conflate energy production with global warming. But that's very far from the case. Greenhouse gases are produced across the economy. 17% of greenhouse gases are produced by energy generation. Heating accounts for 5%, industry 15%, transportation 14%, agriculture 12%, deforestation 12%. Note that this means that even if we immediately replace every fossil fuel-powered electric generating plant in the world with 100% renewable solar, wind, or power, like James Hansen says we should do, this would only reduce greenhouse gas emissions by less than 20%. So any strategy to confront greenhouse gas emissions has to deal with the whole economy, across the economy. Cap-and-trade schemes can't stop global warming. I'll just summarize this, and if you want to look at a detail, look at my article on green capitalism. Cap-and-trade schemes can't stop global warming because they would impose a cap on emissions. Well, a cap on emissions is not acceptable to business because business understands, even if a lot of naive environmentalists don't, that there is no free lunch here. There is no way to cut greenhouse gas emissions significantly without cutting production. And business is not interested in cutting production, and workers aren't interested in cutting production, so mostly they back growth too. And governments are not interested in cutting production either because they need the tax revenues and social peace. So there's no support for cutting emissions. And that's why year after year after year, Doha after Cape Town after Cancun after Copenhagen, all the climate negotiations fail from Kyoto Kyoto on forward, because no one will accept caps. Okay? Carbon taxes can't stop greenhouse gas emissions either. That's carbon taxes are James Hansen is his favorite option. But they can't stop global warming either, because the problem with them is that they don't have a cap. So it's very interesting to see that fossil fuel execs, major fossil fuel execs like Rex Tillerson, CEO of ExxonMobil, and Paul Anderson, CEO of Duke Energy, these guys are in favor of carbon taxes. They're not opposed to them. They're in favor of them because they understand that carbon taxes are just another cost of doing business like other taxes that can be passed off to the consumers and so forth. So they understand that it won't put a cap on emissions. And so that's why, of the two evils, they choose that. They prefer that. Okay. ExxonMobil predicts that in their report this year, predicts that tax or no tax, by 2040, global demand for energy is going to grow by 35%, 65% in the developing world. And nearly all of this is going to be furnished by fossil fuels. ExxonMobil is not looking to leave the oil in the soil as a favor to Bill McKibben and the humans and James Hansen. ExxonMobil is looking to pump it and burn it as absolutely fast as possible to enrich its shareholders. So there's no market solution to global warming. The only way to really cut fuel consumption by 2050 would be to impose an emergency contraction, shut down, or drastically retrench coal companies, oil companies, gas companies, fossil fuel power, electric utilities, and all the industries that depend on them, autos, airplanes, shipping, chemical companies, agribusiness operations, and many more. Same with resource depletion. We're not just in the industrialized, we're not just over-consuming fossil fuels, we're consuming everything on the planet. We're consuming the planet like there's no tomorrow. Two-thirds of the American economy is geared to producing what are called consumer goods and services. To be sure, we need food and clothes and housing and so forth like that. But most of what corporations produce today is not produced for the needs of people, but for the, someone once said, for the needs of corporations to sell to people. Okay? From the ever more obscene and pointless vanities of ruling class consumption, the Bentleys and Maseratis, the Bergdorf Goodman designer collections, the resorts and estates and yachts and condos and jets, and to the endless waste stream of designed-in obsolescence of fashions and cars and furniture and cosmetics and consumer electronics and all the retail malls and office complexes and junk mail catalogs and advertising and banking and credit card so-called industries that keeps this perpetual consumption machine humming along, the vast majority, I would guess, at least three-quarters of what we produce today is just not necessary at all, including the arms industry. It just does not need to be produced at all. It's just a total waste, a resource-hogging waste. And almost all of this has come in my lifetime, since I was born in 1946. Hardly any of this existed before then. I mean, there were cars and houses. My parents lived in a modest house, and they had a car, but nothing like the stuff we consume today. And it's killing us. It's all going to come to a grinding halt, one way or the other. Either we get a grip on this and stop this overconsumption of the planet, or we're going to hurl right off the cliff to collapse. I think there's just no obvious way about it. But here again, there's no way to incentivize BMW to stop producing new cars, or IKEA to stop producing disposable junk furniture, or Apple to stop pushing you to lose your iPhone 4 and buy a 5. That's what they're invested in. That's what they have to do to keep going from year to year. Companies can't change, so they can't change very much. Because it's too costly or too risky, and shareholders won't allow it. Look at what happened with BP. They had a CEO back in the 90s, and he tried to steer the company toward beyond petroleum. You know, they fired him. Mm-hmm. Look at the auto industry today. There's massive overproduction of cars everywhere on the planet. Every industry is overcapacity, and yet none of them can change. And so they're locked into a death march competition to try to undersell each other. So no one can change, and that's the logic of the system. That's the second point. Thirdly, if capitalism can't help but destroy the world, then what choice is there but to nationalize and socialize most of the economy and planet directly? Close down the redundant and harmful industries and redirect those resources to make things we do need. In many cases, this can only be done on a national or global scale because only society can afford to absorb the cost of such restructuring. So to save the humans, we need to plan most of the industrial economy. Actually, we need to plan most of the world's industrial economy. I know this seems completely crazy, but this is the only alternative. For better or worse, we're well into what scientists call the Anthropocene. That is, nature doesn't run the Earth anymore; we do. And as more and more, it's one planet, one people on one planet. We need to begin to make conscious and collective decisions about how our activity affects the natural world. Since the rise of capitalism 300 years ago, more and more of the world has come to be run on the basis of market anarchy. On Adam Smith's maxim that every individual should just maximize his or her own self-interest and look out for number one in the public interest, the common good would take care of itself. Well, that hasn't worked out so well. And the problems we face with planet management can't be solved by individual choices in the marketplace. They require collective, conscious, rational planning, international cooperation, collective democratic control of the economy, not market anarchy. We need to prioritize the needs of humanity, the environment, other species, and future generations. We would have to, if we want to save the humans, we'd have to do at least the following. Put the brakes on out-of-control growth in the global north, retrench and shut down resource-hogging, wasteful, polluting industries, discontinue destructive methods of industrial agriculture, industrial fishing and logging, and so on. Secondly, we'd have to completely reorganize, restructure, reprioritize production and build products we do need to be durable, rebuildable, recyclable, and shareable as much as possible to make things last. Cars, iPhones. It doesn't really need a new iPhone every 3 years. Give me a break. I mean, these things could be made to be rebuildable and usable forever. But, you know, Apple. How can Apple survive if they don't make you throw in the trash? Okay? Thirdly, we need to steer investments into things society does need, like renewable energy, organic farming, public transportation, public water systems, public schools, the ecological remediation, public health quality, health care, quality schools, and so on. Okay? Fourth, we need to equalize development the world over by shifting resources out of useless and harmful production in the north and into developing the south. Actually, if we just stop stealing from the south, they can develop themselves. You know, if we just stop ripping them off, they don't really need so much help from us. Okay? But they need to build basic infrastructure, sanitation systems, public schools, and provide jobs and so forth. Fifthly, we need to devise a rational approach to eliminate and or control waste and toxins as much as possible. Lastly, provide equivalent jobs for workers, guaranteed jobs, displaced by the closing of unnecessary and harmful industries, not just the unemployment line, because we need to make huge changes in the economy. We need to shut down all kinds of wasteful industries and create some other industries, but on balance, to make a lot less stuff. Have longer vacations, shorter working day, just a lot of stuff just not need to be made. And as a consequence, however, people are going to have work to do. There's got to be work to do. There is work to do, lots of work here in this country and other countries and so forth, but we have to devise work that doesn't generate CO2 emissions and pollution and so forth. So other kinds of work. People can be imaginative and think about these. But the point is, those are the sorts of things we need to do to save the planet, save ourselves. Well, how else can this be done except in a mostly planned, mostly publicly owned economy? This does not at all mean, I'm not saying, that we need to nationalize local restaurants and family farms and farmers markets and workers' co-ops and artisans and groceries and bakeries and repair shops and all those kind of things. We don't need to nationalize and plan every aspect of the economy. Small-scale, self-managed producers based on simple reproduction are not destroying the world. Large-scale, capitalist, investor-owned corporations based on insatiable accumulation are destroying the world. We have to nationalize those. Many of them we have to nationalize to close them down, like Monsanto. I can't think of anything Monsanto makes that society needs, honestly. You know, I mean, there are many corporations like that. All the arms industry. Do we need any of this stuff? You know, I mean, we're talking about the facing like the end of the world here. So, you know, you have to rethink about what's really necessary and what's not necessary. Okay, so. I just don't see any reason why we need to nationalize all this local small stuff. And I quite freely grant you, and I'm speaking especially to younger people in the audience, I don't claim to have all the answers here. I know what doesn't work and what won't work, but I quite freely say I don't have a clear conception of how this semi-marketized, lower, small-scale artisan and whatnot economy would merge and work with a largely globalized, largely nationalized and socialized larger scale industry. Well, I can figure that out. You know, I don't think it's so impossible. And there are lots of nationalized industries that work fine in a market economy, so I don't think it's so impossible. But people have some creative work to do here. Okay? Fourthly, rational planning of the sort I'm talking about for an ecologically sustainable society and for a humane society requires democracy. People don't, many people don't like the thought of economic planning. You know, right-wing economists like Milton Friedman denied the very possibility of planning in the economy, equating all planning with Stalinism. I don't buy that. The question is planning by whom, for whom. Stalinist central planning was run from the top down by a bureaucracy for a bureaucracy. And so for a totalitarian bureaucracy, and it completely shut out workers and the rest of society from the planning process. So, of course, it didn't work so well. But I don't see what that tells us about the potentials of planning from the bottom up, of democratic planning. Besides, capitalists indirectly plan the economy all the time. You know, they meet every year at Davos to shape the world market and see how they're going to screw us next year. They conspire to privatize medicine. They get together, corporate get together, and how to privatize medicine, schools, and public transportation, and force us to buy their water or their GMO foods. They use the IMF and the World Bank to shackle countries with debt, and then open them up to U.S. corporate takeover. They've been using their states for centuries to expropriate peasants and tribes and privatize common lands and break up pre-capitalist societies and reorganize and replan whole continents to set up the right business climate for capital accumulation. Late developers like Japan and South Korea use their metis and chaebols to hothouse their industries to protect them and strategically plan their insertion, their integration into the world economy. So capitalists are very good at planning the world economy for their own interests in their way. So I just say, why can't we plan the economy for our own interest? I don't see why not. Solar or coal, frack the planet or work our way off fossil fuels, drench the world's farms in toxic pesticides or return to organic agriculture. Public transportation or private cars as the mainstay. Let's put these big questions up for a vote. Shouldn't everyone who has a say in decisions that affect them all, isn't that the essential idea of democracy? The problem with capitalism is that the economy isn't up for a vote, but it needs to be. Again, in Adam Smith's time, it didn't matter so much because private decisions had such little impact on the planet. But today, huge decisions that affect all of us, other species, even the fate of life on Earth, these are all still private decisions made by corporate boards on behalf of self-interested investors. Polls show that 80% of Americans oppose GMO foods. But what Americans? But Americans don't get to vote on whether we get GMOs in our food. Well, why not? Corporate boards vote to put GMOs in our foods and all kinds of toxic chemicals in our foods besides. We're the ones who consume the stuff. Well, why don't we get to vote on these decisions? We don't have to be experts. Corporate boards aren't experts. They're not composed of experts. George Bush Jr. was on a corporate board before he was president of the United States. He didn't have to know anything about either one of those jobs. Corporate decisions are made by major investors, mostly. They vote on what they want to do, then hire experts to figure out how to implement their decisions. Why can't we do that? To do this, we'd have to set up established democratic institutions to plan and manage our social economy. We'd have to set up planning boards at local, regional, national, continental, international levels. They'd have to include entire communities, consumers, farmers, peasants, everyone, not just workers and technicians. But we have models. We have the Paris Commune, Russian Soviets, Brazil's participatory planning examples, La Via Campesina, and many others. Direct democracy at the base, delegated authority with right of recall for higher level planning boards. What's so difficult about that? Greg Palast described in Democracy and Regulation that the U.S. already has regional planning commissions to coordinate public utilities. These could be democratized and extended and replicated across the economy. Obviously, many issues can't be decided at the local levels. Others, like closing down the coal industry, repurposing the auto industry, require larger scale planning. Some, like global warming, ocean acidification, deforestation, would require extensive international coordination, essentially global planning. That's manageable. We have the UN Climate Convention, which meets annually and is charged with regulating greenhouse gas emissions. They just don't have any enforcement powers, but they need them. Okay, point five. Democracy can only work in the context of a rough socioeconomic equality and social guarantees. That is, we need planning, but the only way planning can work effectively for the commons, for the common good, is when you have a roughly equal society. when in the middle of the Great Depression, Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis said, we can either have democracy in this country or we can have great wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both. He was more right than he knew. Today we have by far the greatest concentration of wealth in history, so it's hardly surprising we have the weakest and most corrupt democracy since the Gilded Age. If we want democracies, we would have to abolish the great wealth concentrated in the hands of the few. That means abolishing not just private property and the means of production, but also extremes of income, exorbitant salaries, great property, and inheritance, because the only way to prevent corruption of democracy is to make it impossible to materially gain by doing so, by creating a society with neither rich or poor, a society of basic economic equality. Does that mean we all have to dress in blue Mao suits and dine in communal mess halls? No, I don't think so. Lots of studies, Wilkinson and Pickett's spirit level, the UK's New Economics Foundation studies and others have shown that people are happier, there's less crime and violence, and fewer mental health problems in societies where income differences are small and where concentrated wealth is limited. We don't have five planets to provide resources for the whole world to live the consumerist lifestyle like those of us have in the advanced industrial countries, so-called advanced. But we have more than enough wealth to provide every human being on the planet with a basic income, with good job and sufficient pay to lead a dignified life, with safe water and sanitation, quality food, housing, education, and health care, public transportation, all the authentic necessities we really need. These should all be guaranteed as a matter of right. And in fact, as indeed most of these were already declared as such in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948, which of course are completely ignored by capitalist governments that signed them. Freeing ourselves from the toil of producing unnecessary and harmful commodities, the three-quarters of junk that we produce that we don't need, would free us to shorten the workday, to enjoy the leisure promised but never delivered by capitalism, to redefine the meaning of the standard of living to connote a way of life that it's actually richer while consuming less stuff, and to realize our fullest human potential instead of wasting our lives in mindless drudgery and shopping. That's the emancipatory promise of eco-socialism. Sixth point. This is crazy, utopian, impossible, and never happen. Well, that's probably true, but what's the alternative? The specter of planet-wide ecological collapse and the collapse of civilization into some kind of Blade Runner dystopia is not as hypothetical as it once seemed. Ask the Chinese. China's capitalist miracle has already driven that country off the cliff into headlong ecological collapse that threatens to take down the whole planet with it. With its rivers and lakes polluted and depleted, with 70% of its croplands contaminated with heavy metals and other toxins, with undrinkable water, unedible food, unbreathable air that kills more than a million a year, with cancer villages metastasizing across the rural landscape, and cancer the leading cause of death in China, in Beijing, China's rulers face hundreds of mass protests, many of them violent, around the world every day to keep the lid on. It's all they can do to keep the lid on. Today, the Chinese and we need a socialist revolution not just to abolish exploitation and alienation, but to derail the capitalist train wreck of ecological collapse before it takes us off the edge. As China itself demonstrates, revolutions come and go. Economic systems come and go. Capitalism has had a 300-year run. The question is, will humanity stand by and let the world be destroyed to save the profit system? There's one page I passed around to people, and I forgot to mention, but if you'll just look at that for just a second, it's quite enlightening about China and the prospects of growth under capitalism. Okay? This is from the Earth Policy Institute at Columbia University. And what you see here is that if China's economy, there's a little section missing here from the beginning, but if China's economy, their projections are, if China's economy continues to grow at about 8% a year, which is what it's growing at right now, by 2035, you can look and see what amounts of things China will be consuming in 2035 versus what the country what the world produced this year and what China consumes this year. So look at oil. China consumed last year 9 billion barrels of oil and 9 million barrels of oil a day. versus the U.S. at 19. But at 8% a year, China will, just China alone by 2035, will be consuming 85 million barrels a year. The whole world only produced 86 million barrels a year this year. So China would consume just a standard average rate of capitalist growth, 8%. I mean, that's high rate, but that's China's rate. It's been higher than 10, 12%. They'll consume, they'll need to consume all the oil that the world produces today. That's a pretty staggering, that's a pretty staggering number. They'll also have to consume, the other percentages. I won't bother to read them. You can read them yourself. You can see what a huge impact this will be if they stay on a, if they keep a market system for that time. So, just to conclude, to the extent that the outcome, whether we can change this world, the extent depends on the outcome of whether the left can answer that alternative. You know, Occupy Wall Street had a brilliant critique of the system, but people said, well, what's your alternative? And they haven't come up with an alternative. That's a big problem. So it's up to us to come up with an alternative with a compelling, plausible vision of eco-socialism and to figure out how to get there. We have our work cut out for us. But what gives us eco-socialists, and I come from this group down, you'll see down there at the table, we have a table, system change, not climate change. What gives us an edge is that in this ideological struggle, capitalism has no solution to the ecological crisis, because the only answer to its problem, every problem it comes up with, is the very same growth that's killing us, more of the same but worse. We're living in one of those pivotal world-changing moments in history. Indeed, I think the most pivotal, the most crucial time in human history. There is no doubt that closing the book on capitalism and building an eco-socialist civilization is the greatest challenge humanity has ever faced. And we might fail, but given that capitalism can only destroy us, what other choice do we have but to try?
Thank you very much, Richard. A grand picture, but at least some moving towards a concrete framework for solutions. So we'll jump right into it, and we'll give it over to Gar Alpervitz. Another nice hand.
So just to begin, let me thank Richard. I think the work he's done is really critical and very important, and we've just heard some part of it, and there's much more that's of great importance. He's challenged Herman Daly on a number of key issues and has not yet. Can't hear? I'll speak up. Raise your hand if you don't hear. I was saying he's also challenged Herman Daly on a number of key issues and beginning to force this debate in wider circles. At the same time, I have some issues with what he said, and I think they go to the heart of where we go and how we build. The central argument about which we agree, and I suspect there's more agreement on other levels as well, is that corporate capitalism must grow. It is not a choice. That is, the simplest way to understand that is any corporation that goes to Wall Street to get its capital, if it doesn't increase its quarterly earnings, will be killed by the market. And they all know that. And so if they don't grow, they are going to be slaughtered. And the motivation both for the corporate owners and for the managers is severe. And so that's one thing that we know about capitalism. And therefore, that path of growth is at dead logically contradicted by the need to constrain growth. So that's one part of the problem. A second part of the problem is slightly different. That is, they must externalize costs. That is to say, they have to pollute. If the next guy that they face is polluting or throwing greenhouse gases into the air, and they spend money doing that, they will lose the competitive race, so they can't do that. And these are the kind of simple dynamics that are at work but have such powerful consequences. The answer that we must have a planned socialist economy is an abstract answer. And this is where the problems become interesting. So, for instance, there was indeed something like a nationalized economy planned and run in the Soviet Union. That isn't what Richard wants or what I want. But it does not tell us enough to say we want planning and nationalization to assume that the culture of that planning will do anything but grow.
It isn't enough to say good guys will run it, and therefore it'll work out. So that's at the level of the ideas and criteria and ecological vision of the planners. There must be in your vision, and indeed in your political economic theory, and in your design, reasons to believe that the institutional structure will, one, constrain the planners and produce the outcome you want, and secondly, and here's a critical point, that the political economic design that you are calling for will also nurture a culture, that means folks at the grassroots level, that actually generate criteria that actually constrain the planners. So you've got a double-level problem, the institutional substructure of the planning system and the cultural substructure of the planning system. Now, this may sound abstract, but that's where the rubber hits the road, and if you don't get to that level, then there is a powerful centralizing trend in all socialist systems that moves the power to the top. So the question becomes, where we strongly agree, is that there must be public ownership, nationalization of the large industries. Otherwise, you can't get at the first dynamic. And probably you can't get at the second dynamic, the growth dynamic, is the first dynamic. And the second one is the externalization. A third dynamic I want to mention is that corporations also have an interest under capitalism in moving the ball around so that they can play communities off against each other and get lower prices and better deals. So if you go to Detroit or you go to Cleveland, Ohio, what you will see is cities of 1 million down to 400,000 or cities of 900,000 down to 300,000 at tremendous human cost. Where did the people go? Nobody gives a damn. At tremendous capital cost, the houses, the roads, the streets, everything else has to be rebuilt someplace else. And at tremendous carbon cost, because all of that is carbon costly. And third and fourth, you can't plan a sustainable community design because they pulled the rug out from under the planning system. So that must, there are many planning problems. We're just identifying a few of them. So that's kind of setting out the set of questions that you would have to answer. And I'll give you one more. If you were to talk about a democratic, socialized planning system that was also ecologically sustainable, it is not enough just to say they'll do it. What's the design look like? And then the second question, how do we get from A to B to C, is intimately related. Let me stress this, because it can be written off very quickly. And Richard, my friend, writes this off occasionally when he and I talk privately. How you get from A to B is part of the problem of how you create the institutional and cultural substructure. You can't just wave a wand. So we're going to come. Let me come back on. So that's the setup for the discussion where he and I agree on 90%, and we're going to hustle back and forth on the next 10% and have some fun with it. All right, so let's get back on the second question. Let me define the fourth problem. In a continental system, you live in a continental system, 300 million, 318 million, continental-wide, almost 3,000 miles coast to coast, the problems of organizing a democratic polity and therefore a democratic planning system are multiplied and distinct from non-continental systems. So let me give an example. We tend to draw our examples for much political economic theory from European countries. And I often say in lectures to my students, we take our ideas from those dinky little countries like Germany, France, England. And they go, dinky. Well, you can drop Germany into Montana. You can drop France into Texas. The problems of organizing a politics in a continent are extreme, particularly a participatory democracy. Imagine what the meaning of participatory democracy means in a continent-wide system of 320 million people, moving to 500 million, and probably, if the census high projection by the end of the century is realized, something of the order of 1.2 billion. So decentralization is also part of any ultimate planning design or any democratic constitutional design in any system, and we haven't yet gotten to that point. So that's the layout of the contours of the problem. We agree that you must nationalize the big firms. Then the question becomes, is there a way, and this gets kind of tricky and critical, is there a way, if you want a democratic process, in the ordinary experience of ordinary citizens, in their day-to-day community life that they begin to experience directly the nature of planning and how it interacts with institutional power, and thereby develop a democratic process and a democratic culture sufficiently powerful and sufficiently informed so that it could begin to generate criteria for higher order planning at the regional and potentially national level. So let me unpack that a little bit. Let me give you an example of some ways in which you can think about that. A socialist planning system inherently actually plans a good part of the public market, as well as owning and controlling. So I'll give you a mini model that's going on in Cleveland right now, and then we'll maximize it. So in the city of Cleveland, many of you know about the Cleveland cooperatives. How many have heard about the Cleveland cooperatives? So let me talk to you about it from an ecological and planning point of view rather than from isn't it nice that the workers get to own co-ops. What you got there is you draw a circle around a community. You set up a community-wide structure, thereby socializing ownership and also decentralizing control. So this, in this case, a nonprofit corporation, it could be a municipal government, could be a region. And then you hang off that worker-owned companies, which have control of production. And in the center of that is a banking system, a revolving fund. So that is a community-wide rather than worker-owned company, worker-owned company, worker-owned company, worker-owned company, which also generate interest groups. Worker-owned companies in a free market economy must externalize costs and pollute. I'm a worker co-op guy. Those of you who like worker co-ops, if you are in a market where you are facing competition and the next guy cuts costs by polluting, you are forced to do it or you die. Secondly, worker-owned companies, and these are the favored models right now, so I'm going to stress this for a moment, and I'm very interested in and written a lot about this. Worker-owned companies in contexts where there are economies of scale technologically. Let me say that again. That means if you invest in equipment, you can lower the cost of your product more than the next guy. There's an economy of scale if you buy big, fancy computerized equipment, and then you drive the next guy out of business. The problem is that if there are economies of scale and technology is always producing them, if you don't follow, wave a hand if you don't follow this economics stuff. Any company that invests in high technology where there are economies of scale by increasing production will get you cheaper and cheaper, cheaper products so that you can sell it cheaper than the next guy, including if you're a worker-owned company, you will knock the next guy out of business. And he will be forced to compete with you and adopt the same technology or he goes out of business, which means that their worker-owned companies are growth-driven also. You get it? It's brutal. Worker-owned companies, when there are economies of scale, are growth. They're not little. They're growth-driven also, and they must compete with each other. And then they begin to generate the results that Richard's given you a sketch of. So, how do you begin to develop an architecture of systems, which begins with a democratic premise, democratizing ownership, but also internalizes externalities? I'll say some more about that term. And also undercuts the growth dynamic, all the while creating a culture of community and democracy rather than of individual firms, in order that the subunits of the system, the communities, generate people, experiences, culture, and institutions which have a shot of containing the larger planning system. Yes? All right, so some part of that requires a worker-owned company externalizes and wins a community-wide ownership structure at the local level. Think Cleveland or my hometown, Racine, Wisconsin. A community-wide that actually owns the production can choose whether it wants to pollute itself or not. But the institutional structure inherently internalizes the externalities. That's economist talk. There is no way to, you can dump some of it on the external world, but a community structure, it inherently internalizes the externalities by institutional design. So one of the contentions would be that unless you build into the substructure of ordinary everyday experience Think Tocqueville, think John Dewey, think Marx and the Commune, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Unless you build into the structure of ordinary experience this experience and something like a design like that, and then make it a democratic process to run the system like a local community, you don't get there because you don't develop citizens and you don't develop culture and you don't develop institutional designs at the level of ordinary life, which have a shot of constraining the next system higher. So it becomes critical to begin to look not at, ain't it nice, there's a lot of little co-ops and farms. That's preliminary to the question. The question is, are we seriously enough engaged in the problem so that we can generate a sufficiently powerful culture and institutional substructure so that the necessary planning that must be done, we agree with the large corporate systems that must be nationalized because otherwise they grow and otherwise they externalize pollution, et cetera, et cetera. How do we build that in a way that actually achieves the result and does it democratically? So that would be my suggestion to you, is that in this brief sketch, you begin to concentrate much more attention in the name of national economic planning and socializing major corporations in order to solve the problem we're talking about and many other problems, that you must begin at the community level to think through the design problem. And it is at the level of experiential design as well as cultural experience. We can layer onto this particular fabric the notion that it would be very critical to manage both the cultural and democratic process problem to radically reduce time of work. That's a big planning problem. In theory, it's a snap. But actually, to build the institutions that would allow you to do that, the power relationships to achieve the result we both share is a big deal. But just to give you a hint of it, most people don't, let me say it this way. We have no economic problem in the United States. What? The United States economy, even today, is producing $200,000 for every family of four, even in its poor performance. We have a massive political problem and an ecological problem in managing the richest economy in the history of the world. But it's not an economic problem. The underlying economics produces far more than is needed. 200K for every family of four right now. So it just gives you an idea. You could cut that, and the reason I introduce it at this point, even today you could cut the work week in half and have 100,000 for every family of four. And that's not even involving cutting out all the waste and crap that Richard began to outline. So the availability of time in order to participate in the processes of democracy and culture is clearly, in this country, available to us given the level of technology. And if the technology, just to sketch it, if the technology were to proceed at the same level in the next century that it proceeded in the past century, we would have a sevenfold increase in output per capita. What? Sevenfold increase. That comes out in the lousy definitional terms of GDP per capita. That comes out $1 million by the end of the next century, by the end of this century, in the next 100 years, or next 87, 83 years, that comes to about $1 million per family of four if we only reproduce the technological gains of the 20th century. And the 20th century, that's the rate of growth of technology, and it's probably accelerating. The 20th century was a lousy economic century. It had World War I, it had a massive depression, it had World War II, it had a lot of wars in between and a lot of stagnation. So it's probably a conservative judgment, but not on ecological grounds, but on technological grounds. Or if you really want to project out the utopian aspects of this, based on the real trends, that comes to about 500,000 and a 20-hour work week, 250,000 in a 10-hour work week. The technology's enormously productive, so open space for a lot of time to participate. That's a bypass on the side. Let me return to the question. Supposing you wanted to get to the result that he and I both share, and you were facing the institutional and the cultural problem, then it would be of some importance to begin to pay a lot of attention to developing at the community level, even as you began calling for nationalization, so that your planning system as you went forward would begin to be based on real experience and the development of people who had some ideas like this. Now, fortunately, there's a lot going on around the country that people are just beginning to be aware of in the nature of democratizing ownership, the beginnings of planning systems, the beginning of trying to take over companies, et cetera, at local level and local experience. And in part, it is developing kind of people who actually know something about what's going on. Now, the Cleveland model, which I mentioned and suggested, is there are about 10 cities that are looking at that, in which the ownership, the structure is something like that, using quasi-government agencies, usually hospitals and universities, to build out around cooperatives in some way that builds community. There are 130 million people involved in co-ops in the United States. Most people don't know that. That's including the one-person, one-vote banks, the credit unions. There are 10 million worker-owned companies in the United States. Most people don't know that. There are more 3 million more workers in worker-owned companies already in the United States than members of unions in the private sector. 20 states have begun to develop legislation, have introduced legislation to set up socialist banks like the Bank of North Dakota, which has been there for 90 years. You can go, there are many, many cities over the last 10 years that have taken back and socialized the municipal ownership of utilities. There are increasing numbers of utilities that are setting up systems for internet, publicly owned internet systems, what, 300 or 400 last time I saw it. There are a number of communities that are capturing methane, 750 city-owned methane captures, using the products in order to make energy and jobs, et cetera. There's an enormous experimentation at the local level beginning to develop actual experience with the models that involve collective ownership under a community structure and beginning to play around with community participation in the design process. So that's a beginning point to look at. And then the question becomes, is there a path from here to there that both allows for the development of what would be required, not just nice, in order to constrain a planning system sufficient unto the task that Richard has defined? And the answer is we don't know that. We don't know whether or not we can do that. But probably there's no shortcut. Because the shortcuts we know about, think Army Corps of Engineers, if you want to see a socialized system that's gone amok under nationalized ownership and exists today, think Atomic Energy Commission, think the United States military, think how bureaucratic systems now running and invading privacy of every person here in the internet, those are all socialized systems. And whether or not we can establish criteria and a democratic form of socializing those systems in the name of handling the problems that we both agree on is an open question. I want to say one other piece. I'll probably say 10 other pieces. Don't trust me if I say only one other thing. I usually say more on. But let me say one other thing. The design question becomes critical. Richard flagged it at the very end. He said it in very general terms. We must come up with it. The design of how it ain't enough to say socialism. It ain't enough to say ecological socialism. The design problem, if you don't like corporate capitalism, you don't like the kinds of socialism we have seen, state socialism, and if you know that worker-owned socialism on its own produces very similar problems, Mondragon is a growth system. Mondragon is competing in the global market, and its name of the game is growth. I favor Mondragon. It's a very interesting model, but it is not at all, free from the pressures we're talking about. Because it's in that model and it's in that system. It is just now beginning to try to green its operations, sort of. But nonetheless, it's in a growth sell model. And that's its structure. So we have not, even in the best models, like ones that are most interesting, we haven't faced the design and the systemic design question at all. And if you begin to face it in the way I've only sketched here, just begun to sketch, you are then forced to say a process which over time would actually achieve that result is necessary. You can't wave your hands. Now, here's what's called a tragedy. This may be a different tragedy of the commons. This is a particular tragedy of the commons. We are bound already, and I want to challenge Bill McKibbins on one hand and maybe my friend Richard on another. The talk about all of the horrors that are going to occur is correct, and usually it's just, if we don't do this tomorrow, we will experience horrors. We can't do it tomorrow. We will experience horrors. The question is whether or not we have a path to delimit and delimit and scale back and understand that so that we can actually get a handle on the problem, recognizing the tragedy of this reality. There is no shortcut. The shortcut leads to Stalinization. Now, I'm exaggerating. It leads to processes which cut short this whole possibility. So the place to do it is to understand the tragedy, to move as fast as you can, but not to ignore what is required to produce a democratic participatory structure, but even more, a democratic participatory, ecologically intelligent culture that can constrain the planning system. That's the nasty part in all of this. And that's why it's so critical in the analysis not to bifurcate the analysis between a socialist system and those little things on the ground that are developing. Those little things on the ground that are developing are the preliminary ingredients out of which we may precipitate an answer to a real answer to the problem that we both share. So I'll leave it at that. Did you have something you want to add to that?
Yeah, my question, I guess, is what do you think the history of communal experiments tell us about the local?
Well, let's go to that after this one, Joe. I thought you were adding to his question. Okay. So, it's very interesting when you actually get into the nitty-gritty of this in any local community. At this stage of development, major corporations are arrogantly oblivious to what goes on in these little things. They think they're tinker toys. So that's one thing. So that we haven't seen that. And we've in fact seen some of these big hospitals and universities, which are large corporations, seeing it to their advantage to boost these things. Whether that will continue, we don't know. But they have some pluses in it. It cleans up the neighborhood. They look good. And some of them... Secondly, some of them, in our experience, and I've randomly ran into the guys doing the worker-owned companies in Chicago this morning on another panel, in their experience, too, they're finding small capitalists who are quite open to this kind of thing and not what you normally would think when you talk to conservatives on television. They're kind of like, it's good for the community. Those guys are working hard. Why shouldn't they own their own company? It's a co-op. It's a very different mentality than the kind of crazy right-wing ideologues that you hear. So it isn't clear where that will happen. At the local level, we haven't yet seen enough power accumulation to challenge major corporations. But implicit in the developmental patterns we are seeing is that, and take the city of Cleveland, the mayor in almost any city is faced with this choice. Bribe the big corporation to come in, give them $100,000 or $200,000 in tax benefits per job. That's the going rate around the country. Bring them in, and they'll stay for a while, and then the money runs on, and then they'll flip to the next guy and just do this around the country. So that's the game. Building up these local alternatives begins to give the mayor an option, different job structure, put his whatever funding he's got into these structures. We haven't yet seen that. I think where the push will come is when you get to much larger scale. In a way, so let me give you an analogy. In a way, it's like peasant challenges in the Vietnam War. At the extreme ends of the empire, Detroit is the extreme end of the empire, and so is Cleveland, and so is Youngstown, Ohio. At that end of the empire, the pain levels are so high that people are beginning to move in very different ways, pushing back from the outside, not a frontal attack centrally, but building from the outside power slowly. And it reminds me of those kind of wars. So I don't know the answer. We'll see what happens later.
Well, I don't have any answer directly to that question about the capitalist reaction. I have some other thoughts. I don't know. Should I?
Sure.
Should we just take questions?
Yeah, good thoughts.
Well, just to clarify a little bit, Gar, I have to say that I'm surprised and pleased that you find yourself in agreement with me about nationalizing and socializing means of production, the major means of production and planning the economy. Because I read your book and you didn't say anything about that. What you said in your book is about about worker-owned co-ops buying out industries, like when guys retire and so forth, and they find tax advantages to sell to their businesses to their employees. But all of this is organized through the market. And my problem with the market organization, I'm all for small scale, and I think that. That nonetheless, I'm saying I don't see a need to plan the smallest scale operations. I just don't see any reason to bother with that. But so forth. But I do see a problem of organizing the whole economy larger scale production via the market. And even worker co-ops, because it all depends. You need socialization of the means of production coordinated with rational planning. For example, like Mondragon. Mondragon. People look to Mondragon as a model, and Gar's right to point out that it has to grow and so forth. But not only that, but look at what it makes. You know what Mondragon makes? Its Fagor brand refrigerators. That's its main production thing. Washers and dryers and toasters and coffee makers and whatnot. These are not products designed to last as long as possible, to conserve as much resources as possible. They're flimsy, plastic, sheet metal affairs, no more long-lived than the average. I have at home my mom's 1939 Sunbeam toaster that'll outlast anything a Fagor makes. You know, it's been around for more than half a century. You know, so it makes a matter of what they're doing. And to a large extent, see, the problem with worker ownerships of industries in general, I think, is that if you find that to have a rational, ecological, sustainable economy, you need to close down those industries because what they make is, in this case, junk. What you need to do is reassign those workers to make something else, completely reconceive the structure and production of what they do at Fagor and Mondragon. Well, then the worker ownership itself becomes a barrier to the social needs of society to reorganize production. So that's what I find is a problem with the worker ownership model beyond like small scale shops and so forth. You know, when you get up to talking about bigger things, bigger investment, more technology, well, technology and what? Should they be free to decide what to make, or should society decide what should be made? Should society put it up for a vote? You know, if they see in capitalism, producers are free to produce whatever they want, whatever they can sell. But I'm saying that in a sustainable economy, we can't allow that anymore because the scale of technology and the scale of production and the power of technology means that even fairly small corporations have the power to make very big impact on the planet. Well, we just can't let that happen. You know, this is not Adam Smith and factories of 200 or 300 people. You know, we're talking about big scale operations that have big impact on the planet. So that's my problem with workers' co-ops beyond. The kind of base small level of.
I get a footnote. Yeah. Those of you who would like, this book is about transitional strategy primarily, but I urge you to read the chapters in part 5 and 6 where we talk about nationalizing corporations and the afterword in which a planning system is sketched.
Oh, okay, I'll look that up.
Read it up again.
Okay. I wanted, that's great. I'm glad.
Let's take a few questions at one time and then we'll give Gar and Richard a chance to respond. Let's finish up with the gentleman in the back who's there.
Really quick. Local experiments might just be seen as kind of a sideshow, but capitalism uses a different thing to it, but they'll never move beyond that stage without some kind of evolutionary, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do you respond to that?
He wants to take a few questions, I think.
My name is Clinton Flanagan, and I would like to ask you from what you were explaining to us in reference to the Smilla situation. I just want to know what you think of it. If the community would take control of its own economic base, create environments, and take individuals within their community and train them to service their own neighbors, where the money stays within the community. And even though you're saying a lot of stuff that's being made is junk, but the profit still stays within that community, which will strengthen that community. What do you think of that?
One more. I
guess I'd like to ask each of you just to respond in however you feel it's relevant to a single word, population. Okay? In terms of time, we've got 200,000 new people here each day.
Population.
Those three questions of Tinker Toys, are they just Tinker Toys, of empowering the community with those profits and the population?
I'll take the last one because nobody ever asked that from socialist groups. You know, it's interesting. You know, frankly, I just think the whole world needs a one-child policy. You know, I mean, not coerced, we just need to reduce. I was born in 1946. There were like 4 billion people on the planet, and now they're like 7. I mean, how long can this go on? This is crazy. So, you know, we can't do that. But in order to do that, you would have to have, an eco-socialist economy. I mean, how else could you? You need to have social support for everybody so they don't need to have raised children to support them in their old age. You know, that you need to have free and health care and birth control so people control the number of children they want. But, you know, you can't do that in this kind of society. You need to have all this institutional stuff in place so people can control their reproduction in a rational way. You know, I mean, but we do have to face it. We've got to make some space for other critters on the planet. You know, we just can't hog everything on the whole planet, you know. I mean, people have to get a grip, you know, but that's not exactly. But having said that, you know, the population has increased by four times, several times since the 1940s when I was born. But consumption of resources has multiplied. You take the resource, steel, 14 times, coal, 24 times. Umpteen times increase in resource consumption, and that's not driven by population, that's driven by capitalism. It's capitalism that's overwhelmingly destroying the planet. But having said that, we still do need to think about population just on the side, but it's not the main driver of ecological collapse in my view at all.
So I agree what it would take to deal with, to accelerate the reduction in the growth of population. But in fact,
just reduction of the population? Like, the growth, I mean. Yeah, we're only like 7 billion. We're like 9 billion people who live like wall to wall, you know? I mean, the whole planet.
But I'm agreeing with you. Be relaxed. I'm saying that there are many things that would help us reduce population. And you've outlined some of them. But what I was going to note is that in most of the advanced systems, except the United States, in fact, population is stabilizing and going down. That's not happening in much of the rest of the world.
Anywhere near fast enough. And you just said population is growing up in this country.
That's what I said. This is the one country that's not true.
Oh, yeah, but... Well,
but it's in Germany, it's going down. It's going down rapidly. In Russia, it's going down. In most countries, in Japan, it's going down. So there's interesting things going on with population, and it would accelerate were we to do the kind of things he's talking about. So let me go to the two questions about. I do agree on money staying in the community to the degree possible is significant and useful in reconstruction of local economies for the reasons outlined earlier, but it's not the whole answer.
Well, I understand that, but you are empowering individuals within that community, and you are redirecting that spending.
Yeah, and you're beginning.
And he eventually takes control of his own economic base.
And beginning, most people don't know what an economy is.
Well, they just don't know what teaching.
That's part of it is to reconstruct the knowledge of what a communalistic system of economics actually is, and then it gets away from abstraction. People say, "Oh, yeah, that's how it works." So that's. I agree with what you just said in principle. The question about it won't work. I mean, somebody up there, is he still there? Yeah, Sharpen, say that question again, please. I want to be sure I answer. I agree. I think you're going to need a frontal assault on these on the big corporations. We'll see about the state. The state may, what the state is. So this is an interesting point. It is one, the theory that the state itself will be taken over, boom, like that one moment, and that is the revolution, is bullshit. Because the state, then, all those structures are the dominant form that, in fact, you're working with institutionally. So that model, I don't think that's the likely model. I think the likely model is reconstructive, elements and chunks that move and restructure and remove pieces and change the pieces and rebuild the culture. I think it's very much more complex than that, and therefore possible to create the kind of culture and democracy that are preconditions of a planning system. So for instance, let me give you a couple biggies. I'll give you three examples that would of how we might move over time. One, it is clear that the big banks are going to go into crisis again. Almost every expert, left, right, and center, including the right wing, expects that for all the reasons. They're much larger now. They're risking higher. They're creating craziness. They will explode again. And maybe if the liberals are successful, they will then, this is Jared Brown, and this is the new nostrum, we'll break them up. That's the current nostrum. And then they will regroup. When the big fish eat the little fish, like AT&T and, you know, Standard Oil, that's almost predictable. So the question is, over a couple cycles of that, even as outside of that we're building state banks like the Bank of North Dakota, that process, at some point I think we'll nationalize them. But that's a chunk, not the state. I think that will happen. I think the right wing will join us because there's more anger by the Tea Party at the banks than there is in the left. So I think that's the kind of shelving off. So another piece of it, if you look at what's happening in healthcare, as I said, many of the states are going to carry the burden of this monstrosity. And the cost structure is impossible, and they're going to be forced into something like single payer. State by state, I call it checkerboard, state by state by state. That's 20% of the economy over time, halving off. So I think that's the process we're looking at. And there may be some explosions where other things will happen. But if you look at it that way, and a third one is, I don't know if any of you noticed, but we did nationalize General Motors, Chrysler, and AIG, the largest insurance company in the history of the world, when we had a crisis. Did you notice? Yes. Tell me that nationalization is impossible.
We didn't.
Well, let me finish. We gave it back when the profits were made, and you can well, I'm saying we got a couple rounds to go, buddy. It is not impossible for the United States to nationalize, and when there is a powerful enough movement, mad enough as they were at those companies with a little more knowledge and experience in the basis, maybe we'll keep them, start making mass transit vehicles rather than these gas guzzlers. So the processes are different than the state will fall. Maybe. I mean, look, everybody's speculating on the basis of the best information and study that they've had. Nobody knows the answers to this. My assessment is that that is an option that we may be able to pursue, local as well as national, but it isn't quite like the state, whoopee, and then we get it, and then the state's got you. You ain't got the state because all those structures are there, and what you got is a monstrosity that you then think you can control rather than be controlled by. Anyway, you heard my sermon, so I'll stop here.
I thought they both were very plausible and also very compatible. I didn't see necessarily any disagreement because I haven't read your work. I've just gathered things about workers' co-ops and all that. And I was never sure whether this was an alternative model, you know, for the future or something nice, you know, that's not dismissive, but good for now and also as a process of building towards something else. And the latter I find reasonably plausible, but is it necessarily, I don't know about whether the question raised earlier, whether it will can go up, you know, but I'm not sure that it's better than other kind of strategies that socialists might engage in, you know, building capacities and organization and experience, say, within union movements or other communities, kinds of struggles, or et cetera, et cetera. So as one strategy building democratic movements and experience, it seems plausible, but I don't necessarily see why it's better than those. And just if you could elaborate on how the community model internalizes the externalities. I didn't understand that entirely.
And last one. Yes.
Yeah, I was just wondering what the two of you thought about how new technology, specifically the 3D printing technology, as it moves beyond just plastic and gets into metals and glass and electronics and all this sort of thing, takes the manufacturing that was a large scale operation and brings it home to individuals, you know, desktops, sorts of things, even garages and whatnot. You know, you're no longer worried about is there going to be a co-op, is it going to be a state run thing. Individual people that can recycle materials, build what they want, touch something. How do you think this sort of technology as it grows and expands is going to factor into all of these sort of predictions about the future?
No, I don't. I'm sorry, but I didn't hear most of your question. Can you just speak up a little louder?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm a little... Yeah.
That's all right. Yeah. I was wondering how you think new technology like 3D printing, which allows individuals...
Yeah, that's what I thought you said. Yeah. All right. And I still don't understand the question. I don't know. What can 3D printing do?
What
can 3D printing do? It just allow us to make more junk that we don't need.
Well, it'll allow us to recycle the raw materials that we've wasted.
Oh, how does this allow us to save raw materials that are wasted? What does it produce? It uses plastic to produce whatever it produces.
It's not
right?
Just plastic, though. We're getting the metals, we're getting into glass, electronics themselves can be printed. I mean,
so
to the point where we can make
But this stuff has to be made and produced. I mean, it just doesn't, we can't suck it out of our thumb. It all comes from something, you know. There's no magic way of making some 3D printers don't print something out of nothing. They produce something out of something.
But perhaps they might be more efficient in the manufacturing process. That might be the man's point.
It could be. So if it produces more junk that we don't need faster and at less cost, is that better?
Exactly. What do you mean by efficient?
Are they going to have more? How many? Hey. Do you want to? There are three questions on the table. You want me to just?
Yeah.
Yeah. So on 3D printing, I don't know where that technology will go, but I think, apart from what Richard says, with which I agree, we don't need more junk. Increasing human efficiency is a great achievement.
Yeah.
And if that's what it does, we don't know how the other aspects of it. Let's do it. But you know, one has to really look closely at technologies, and so there's a big if that's true. Yes, to do it. The other question, there's one question about worker. That's a really good, very important question about the workers and planning, the question that you asked. And I agree with Richard on this one. I do not think worker ownership and worker control of all production is correct. I disagree with some of my colleagues and comrades because the workers in any specific industry or any specific company tend to narrow their focus on what it is they want to do. I do think that, you know, and they are not the same as the unit of the community as a whole. So going over to production control and all of the externalities that go with that is not necessarily in the interest of the community as a whole. There is always a balancing act between the collectivity of the community, which includes about half the people who are not workers,
the elderly, the infirm, the people in school, the people taking care of children, all of whom, to use some old Marxist language, are necessary for the reproduction of the working class. All of those people have an interest in what is produced, not just the workers. So just to give you an edge on it, if you really want worker control of all units, you give the police control of the police rather than the municipality, which is the collectivity. So that's where I'm, and a lot of people don't agree with that in the worker ownership movement, and I think that fight is a very important struggle to work out for the purposes of democracy. So critically, that they be involved deeply and at many levels control, but not the overall question of planning, which is a much larger collectivity of all of us. So that's where I'm at on that question. You asked about the internal. I was using economist language, so, you know, that's economist language. If the ownership of the production is the city, then if that production produces pollutants, they are polluting the city. And the city can decide whether its own industry wants to pollute its people as its own cost. It's internal to the structure of the city. If the company owns it and pollutes and externalizes it, it's all good for them. They don't give a damn. The city gets to choose something else. So it externalizes those costs onto somebody else. A city or a nation can't do that, so it must face the problem of, yeah, okay, we're going to pollute ourselves, or not, but it's not like we can dump this off. You're dumping it on yourself. That's all I meant by a structure of ownership that includes a collective ownership of the community inherently forces that. Doesn't mean it solves it. They may decide to pollute themselves. I mean, don't kid yourself. A lot of people in the country wonder. Their companies are pouring cancer out of their smokestacks. The city wanted it. Mm-hmm. We want it. We'll take the cancer. We don't want to lose the jobs. Ugly choice. That's okay. There was one other question about. What was the other question?
Well, I asked whether if this is sort of a way of building experience, capacity, organization, culture of workers towards some
yes.
further end. Then is it necessarily better or just compatible with other means such as...
Oh, unions and so
yeah.
forth. Yeah, I think that the modeling question of the design problem is really critical, that is beginning to build up these forms. They are compatible also, and I certainly argue it in the book, with a whole series of other things that are going to be needed for a progressive movement to achieve what it wants to achieve. So there's a lot of other elements, and you know, including unions. The unions are dying. The structure of unions has gone, as I said, from 35% down to going to 6%, going to 5% in the private sector. So that power base is a whole, we haven't talked much about power. The institutional reconstruction of the kind I'm talking about is also the construction of an alternative institutional power base for politics. That's a whole other piece of this puzzle, how you build co-ops and worker-owned companies and land trusts. And this stuff also has political implications if you begin to see it as part of a political power base. But the union game, which I'll take as much as we can get, is really on the dying end. It's going down radically.
Let's take one more round of questions, and then we can finish up. Yeah, question.
So I think in line with that question, my question would be about, what this question is about industrialized West. You know, so what would the field look like for developing countries in the South, where, they're still like,
So this is a question for Garb. So at the end of the day, what sort of political system do you envision is most naturally compatible with an economic democracy model? Would it be something like participatory politics that Stephen Chalant has proposed, or something other than that? How would you envision getting there? And this is actually, I have a quick question for Dr. Smith as well. So you seem to be advocating democratic planning as a replacement for markets as a means of mediating supply and demand. So David Schweikert critiqued this idea in the context of Michael Albert's Paracom model, where you have workers and consumers councils and review boards, which plan out basically production and consumption throughout an entire year. And he gave some pretty compelling arguments, in my opinion, for why such a model is not practically feasible. And he argued, in my opinion, pretty convincingly, that one needs, at the end of the day, some sort of market structure to mediate supply and demand, though he does have an alternative system that he proposes, which is based on workers' cooperatives. I'm curious if you come across that type of argument against the impact plan.
Take that first.
Okay. So I read David's critique of that, and I agree with him about the Paracom model. Albert's model is a little odd. It's basically a kind of a negotiation between producers and consumers. Like individual factories that would negotiate with the people who are the buyers and so on. This is just so limited and so narrow because it's just focusing on like little factories right here. But how do you negotiate with Apple, which is in California and China, for your computer, or lumber that comes from South America, or food that comes from around the world? How can you do this on this kind of basis like this? So I think that that kind of little negotiation between producers and consumers, but even more problematic is what do you do if what Gar and I were just talking about, if you have to shut the factory down to save the planet? I mean, What do you say to those workers? I just think you have to have socialization of the major means of production and socialized planning by the whole society, not just the workers. Forget it. Like Gar said, there are lots of people who aren't workers. They're dependents, but they should have a right. They're consumers. They're people who work for the government or all kinds of things, not in producing goods and services, but in other areas of life, childcare, a million things. They should have as much a right to say about what gets produced for food. Why shouldn't they get a vote on whether GMOs in their food just because they're not making food? Should only the people who make cars get to say what goes in cars, or food gets to go in goes in food? So you need to have a socialized planning process in which you basically put what I argue in my stuff, and I promise to have this book done this year sometime later this year. But I'm publishing it chapter by chapter, so if you go to Real World Economics Review, you can read a couple of chapters. Because I'm too busy working to get the book out, but it'll get out in a while. But what I say is that you need to have various states, levels of planning for the different processes, different issues we need to face. Like for global warming, we need to have some kind of scientific body that can give us a stand-up, up-and-down argument and vote on the big questions. If it's a question of like coal power or fossil fuel power versus solar power, I don't see why we can't put this up for a vote. We don't have to be experts about all this. Science, we get rid of Fox News so you can have a decent discussion of things, And you have credible scientists up there who make the best presentation they can, and you vote it, and that's the best shot you have. Whatever you do, the chances are a broad democracy will make better decisions than the capitalists, because the capitalists can't make decisions in society's interests. They can never make the right decisions, because they're always in the interests of private shareholders, never in the interest of society. I'm not saying society wouldn't make mistakes. Of course they'll make mistakes sometimes, but at least they won't be systematic errors, as is the case with private corporations, and would also even be the case with worker-owned corporations, because if the workers own the automobile plants, and you're talking about planning the economy, if workers are facing layoffs, of course they're going to say, we want to build cars, Even if what society says is, well, we think you guys are really good builders, but we think you should build not cars, you should build trains or subways, or something like that, or buses or something like that. We'd love you to do that. Okay? So that, I think you have to have community and community decisions about local things, larger scale, national, regional decisions about bigger issues, and whole global decisions about things. I mean, you look at the polls, you know, Noam Chomsky was quoting these polls time and again. He does this all the time. It's so great. You just see, actually, people's instincts on most of these questions are pretty good. I mean, you really need like a shadow democracy to see what people actually think about the issues and compare with what the capitalists and what the capitalist government does in their ostensibly in their name. But people are pretty, you know, like the poll showed, for example, in California at the last election, population was overwhelmingly in favor of labeling GMO foods, and they're overwhelmingly actually opposed to GMOs. But did they get a vote on this? No. Well, there was a vote to label it. But what happened? The polls were showing that the population was overwhelmingly in favor of it, and then the GMO industrial complex threw $49 billion into a scare campaign and scared people, and then lost by a couple of points. You know, well, if you take money out of that, and you out of that kind of thing, and you have an honest debate between scientists, I don't see why we can't have decent democratic decisions about major issues that we face, and then we can hire the experts to solve the problems. That's what the corporations do. They hire experts to solve their problems.
But the question is, how do you we are already over time.
Yeah. Okay.
I want to give Gar a response really quickly before we...
Yeah, just let me... I'm not going to respond to everything, but you have raised the critical question of the Global South, and...
Oh, absolutely.
And that is critical. So that it is clear that you cannot have a solution that leaves these people in dire poverty. There must be an alternative path for development, and that's going to have some costs. And either that's going to mean planetary difficulties all over, we're all going to have to absorb it, or the West's going to be able to cut back. But there is, I mean, in my view, and the question is how you can make it happen politically, the goal would be reduced growth here and expanding and allowing growth there. That's a tough, brutal decision for these systems to make, and we shall see. I think it's another place where there's going to be messy tragedies all the way through because the power relationships are so obscene. I don't have an answer.
Great. Well, this is a pleasure for me to hear about the...
Thanks for listening to the Gar Alperovitz podcast. To find articles, interviews, audio, video, and more, go to www.americabeyondcapitalism.com.